Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu. Welcome back to the early morning Sunday show here on Radio Islam International. My name is Anisa Isak, and at this time every Sunday morning we have our conscious consumer slot with Mufti Muhammad Hafiji, who is part of the Jamaatul Ulama Finance and Economics and Finance Desk, that is. And we are speaking on quite a few interesting topics again today. I must say our topics are always interesting on this slot, and I hope that our listeners it's an interactive slot, so you're welcome to either call through on 011-854-1548, or if you'd like to maybe send me a text with a question or a suggestion or something that you would maybe want to ask Mufti with regards to consumer and, you know, finances, that kind of thing. And inshallah, if he's able to answer for you immediately, he will do so. The number to send that text to is 084-030-9955. That's 084-030-9955. Mufti, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu, and jazakallah for having me this morning.
It's my pleasure, and I hope that you are well this morning.
Alhamdulillah, through Allah's grace and mercy.
Ameen. All right, let's see that. Are we talking today a little bit about marriage? How to get married without creating a hole in your pocket? I think that is something, a really, really important topic, especially for young brides out there who are embarking on this particular journey.
Most definitely. But, you know, the thing is, when it comes to getting married and the finances of marriage, there is both the positive side of things and then the negative side, right? On the positive side, I think it is the time of the year, it's the season of the year when many individuals try to aim for the actual tying the knot, you know. So the next few months we'll see a lot of that, and then we hope that those individuals who are embarking on this major step in their lives, Allah Ta'ala grant them happiness and immense barakah in their lives going forward, inshallah. On the negative side, and this is why the topic becomes so important to discuss, is that according to StatsSA, this is now official statistics, that 4 out of 10 marital relationships end up in a divorce before the 10th anniversary. And according to these statistics, it speaks for itself that a lot about this kind of statistic and why things don't work out is about how the relationship or the union starts from a financial perspective. Because many a time when the start is not on a good footing, on a good note, from a financial perspective, it places immense strain on the overall relationship going forward. So this is why it becomes so important to consider the whole aspect about getting married without creating a hole in one's pocket and managing the financial aspect of the marriage. I think I just want to focus on the first phase of the marriage rather than the marriage itself, you know. I'm just looking at the actual event of the marriage and the actual function, or even the way where you're inviting people over and having family over to celebrate the momentous occasion. I'm just confining our discussion to that specific aspect because of the kind of financial commitment involved at that stage of the relationship going forward. So I just have a few points, and I'm sure if our listeners have got any others, they are free to share them with us for the benefit of the other listeners, inshallah. But let's start off by saying that when it comes to getting married or that starting out, you know, that first event, the most important factor is to decide what is important for you and your family, what matters most for you and your family. If this speaks to the kind of priorities that people have in leading their lives. And I'm referring to the whole aspect of just simplicity, frugality, making sure that you're driving force in making decisions regarding that whole walima or function that you're going to have. You should not be pleasing someone or competing with someone. It should be determined by, your decision should be determined by what is important for you, for your family, for your child who is getting married. That is what should primarily drive every decision in whatever arrangement has to be made. So that's the first point. The second point is the simple aspect of sitting down with a pen and paper, for those who are more comfortable with pen and paper, or for those who are more tech-savvy, they use spreadsheets nowadays for every little thing. sit down, whatever format you take, but sit down and plan, you know, write down, put down numbers, put down figures, put down items as much as you can. And many a time sitting down as a family can actually help in this regard, because you tend to, the list tends to be more exhaustive of what kind of expenses can we expect to incur and what sort of values will be attached to those specific expenses. And then obviously there will be pruning of that specific list to determine what's important, what's not important, what can be cut out, what should be added on, and so forth. So that specific sitting down with a pen and paper or a spreadsheet, whatever form it takes, is extremely crucial when it comes to planning the specific event of a nikah or a marriage for that matter. The third aspect is the issue of a list, a guest list. You know, obviously that occasion is driven by the guests who are going to be invited. And that list is extremely important because it obviously determines and it has a huge say in terms of how much money is eventually spent. So that guest list is important. I'm sure it goes without saying it doesn't need anyone to come and talk about the importance of a guest list. Everyone has a guest list when it comes to having, whether you're having 10 people over or 100 people over. You know, you have to have a list of priorities. Who do you really want around you? But my point is, many a time when it comes to these guest lists, there isn't sufficient discipline or even understanding from the other side to say, you know what, there are constraints when it comes to managing a guest list, and therefore everyone cannot be invited. You know, there has to be a cap somewhere, and that list has to be pruned over time in the lead up to that specific event, so that we do not get married and leave a hole in our pockets. So that's the third aspect, and then the fourth aspect is, you know, there's one thing that's really changing in our community these days, and this is the issue of how people are informed about key events. I'm just referring to key events, and I'm shifting a little bit away from marriage, but the concept is definitely relevant for marriage itself. What I'm talking about is, if a person has a newborn baby these days, it's a thing of the past to have something printed on a piece of paper or cardboard, whatever it is. Nowadays, people just prepare a banner, an e-version of a banner, and circulate it over social media. The same concept can probably be transposed into the whole marriage context, and you'll find an amazing amount of money is saved in terms of printing costs, which are normally or have been incurred in the past when it comes to wanting to invite people. So, a simple e-invite it does the job, and it can be quite as decorative as you want it to be, as attractive as you want it to be, without the necessary cost without the cost that goes with printing that very same invite. You know, so if you think of like printing an invite with multiple colors and designs and what have you, there'll be a different kind of cost to the whole exercise. But when it comes to an e-version of an invite, it's very different. And by and large, most people, young and old, tend to be having some sort of access to these things. And you can always verify or find a way of determining whether the individual received your invite or not. But my point is, there are ways of moving away from the traditional forms of inviting people, which were cost-intensive, and now move something towards something which is more cost-effective. You know, and then the final aspect from my side is the all-important part of a buffer when it comes to any financial commitment. It's something that is known but often or less often emphasized, where in making any kind of financial commitment, whether it's travel, whether it's school fees, whether it's a marriage for purposes of our discussion, there has to be some kind of buffer for expenses which have not been catered for or planned for. That buffer is important, and the same we've said in the past about retirement. You know, you need to have that buffer emergency fund which you tap into for any unforeseen expenses in the overall event of a nikah or walima for that matter.
I think that's very important advice, especially when like you said, stats have revealed that marriages tend to break up. Usually one of the problems is finance. And if you start off on the wrong footing in that area, then obviously you're going to... cracks in the marriage very early on. And to avoid that, some of the things that you've mentioned can help save money, because that is money that you want to use towards the beginning of a new life, a new part of your life. And it can be, you know, you need to start, as we would say in the accounting field, you want to start in the red, I think it is, or in the black, one of the two.
In the red, yes.
I thought as much. In the red. So you want to start off that way, and you want to keep it on an even keel. So having finances at hand and knowing that you have something aside for a rainy day at the beginning makes it easier as life goes on during that marriage, because you can build on that nest egg for all the other things that you may need.
Yes. I think the point is spot on, because if you look at the kind of economic climate we're living in, you know, it's so relevant to make sure that rather than spending a lavish sum of money on a small event which is going to be most probably forgotten, or if anyone remembers, they will have very critical views on the event, you know, rather say the same amount of money will be allocated for some other important and more pressing need of the couple going forward. Those kind of decisions are important, and considerations are important when it comes to how we make decisions on the overall event itself.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, when you look at the marriages that are, the weddings that are, you know, take place today, they are quite lavish weddings. And I know that every bride wants to have something that's really something to remember and for everybody to remember. But I think more importantly is to think about the fact that a wedding lasts for a few minutes, but a marriage should last you for a lifetime, inshallah. So that's more important than having, you know, impressing people, because at the end of the day, that money that you use for that particular couple hours could actually rather stand you in better stead with your finances as life goes on, not a wedding.
Indeed. I think many people who go through life, even though having had a lavish wedding, they would one day acknowledge themselves that it wasn't actually worth it. They could have been better use for those resources.
Mm-hmm.
People themselves actually acknowledge this. And I think many parents need to wake up to this reality that your definition as a parent of what's best for your child is very different, and it may not be what your child actually wants. So a parent may reason to himself or herself that I really want to give them the best and most memorable thing, you know. It's well intended, but from a financial perspective, there are better priorities towards which those resources can be channeled.
Absolutely. All right, and then we move on to another very controversial subject, and that's the Black Friday fever. You have some tips for us to survive Black Friday?
I think, as you mentioned, you know, Black Friday for us as consumers in the Islamic economic paradigm, we have a very different theory when it comes to the contribution of consumers to the overall economy. In the conventional sense, consumption in the economic terminology actually drives growth of an economy, because if you think about it, the more you and I consume, the more you and I contribute to the supply chain of individuals and lives that are involved in producing a particular product. That's the conventional wisdom of consumer behavior. But for us as Muslims, we have a very different paradigm when it comes to consumer behavior. And this is a topic within economics that is largely ignored. Behavior itself is emerging in other disciplines, in other countries, but behavior itself in the South African context, it's very seldom the subject of study in terms of determining policy or even way forward, you know. But be that as it may, I found it very staggering to note that despite the poor economic climate in this particular financial year or this particular season of Black Friday, there is an expected increase of 30% compared to last year in terms of sales. So large retailers, supermarkets are expecting a 30% increase in terms of spending of ordinary consumers, which says a lot if you really dig deep into the stats behind this kind of prediction and forecast. But I think for me, I just want to say to all our consumers and reach out to as many listeners as we can to approach Black Friday with eyes open. And here are just five basic tips to keep in mind. Number one is, whenever you see those luring promotions and so forth, don't forget to compare them to the regular prices of that same commodity. Because that you may be surprised to note that there isn't a very big difference between the regular price during the year and the time now on the occasion of so-called Black Friday. That's the first thing. Compare the regular price with the current promotional, so-called promotional price. The second thing is, if any consumer is interested in a particular product and it so happens that you need to incur or get involved in credit to finalize that transaction, then it's a complete no. Just forget about it. The moment you have to think about using a credit card, and number one is having to repay the thing over a period of time. One is swiping the credit card but paying it immediately, you know, more than 24 hours. But the other is engaging in credit and having to service a loan or repayment for the next 6 to maybe 12 months. You know, the moment you have to engage in credit, avoid it. It's not the right thing to do. Many a time I find when it comes to, if I just add this aspect of credit transactions, you'll find that the pleasure you derive from that particular item does not outlive the actual repayment period. In the sense that your pleasure from the item is derived, you needed the item for a particular need, whatever, it's fulfilled, the need is fulfilled, but you still have this repayment that is on your back and on your shoulders. So many credit transaction is like that. You've derived the pleasure already and you still have to service the thing, which is not a nice feeling. So that's the second thing. If you need to have engaging credit, forget about it, or think twice at least. Number three is don't overlook the reality of what marketing experts call doorbusters. The doorbusters are those discounted items which are heavily discounted. Just as you enter the landing page of a website, or when you enter a supermarket, just at the very entrance, the first thing that meets your eyes, those doorbusters, in either context, whether it's the online version of transacting or even the physical store marketplace, the doorbusters are something to be careful of, because in simple terms, those items are heavily reduced. But the same level of reduction in price, percentage-wise, is not applicable to the rest of the items in the store. So you'll find maybe, any commodity for that matter will be discounted by 30%, the doorbuster. But in store, everything else will just be discounted by 5% or something of that sort. So that's a reality that consumers have to be aware of. But number three, number four is, think about whether this is going to be your last and even your best time to be shopping. If you've come to the conclusion that it's your last chance to do shopping and there's no more life left, you know, then you can, there's a case for someone to go into some kind of spending spree there, but inevitably you'll get another chance and there will be a better time for shopping. So it doesn't have to be now on Black Friday. And then the last aspect is, if a person is constrained and you need specific items, make sure you have a budget. So from your disposable income, from your salary, you determine your disposable income. You know, okay, rent is sorted out, this payment is sorted out, this payment is sorted out. Now I have 5,000 rent remaining. From this 5,000, I'm willing to spend 1,000 rent for promotion that I see in the next 2 or 3 weeks for Black Friday. And keep it to that. Stick to that budget. It will make a huge difference in terms of financial planning going forward and saving a bit for another rainy day. Those are my five points for dealing with Black Friday this particular year.
One of the things that I find about Black Friday, or I have noticed, and I'm not someone that likes shopping, so shopping malls are not my favorite place, and when it's busy like that, I would steer clear of a place like that. I've noticed that many a times I find people who've been to these Black Friday sales complain, even if it's online, that there are certain things, and maybe we don't take stock of it, but the specials are usually limited stock, and there's a lot of mass psychological manipulation in getting people to purchase these items. Like, for instance, you will find that you could go into a store and you go walk in there, and like you said, the first couple items at the door may have generous savings. But as you walk through, you will find that the savings on other items aren't as generous. And sometimes, because you think it's at a good price, you tend to buy things that you don't even need.
Yes.
You know, and it's unnecessary spending for you in that way. And I think in some cases, I find that the Black Friday sales, and, you know, people are open to, it's my opinion, so they're open to say that I'm wrong, but I think there's a lot of trickery and psychology used to get people to actually buy things.
Yes.
I don't think all of it is actually worth it. You have to be very, very careful.
Very careful. You know, I'm sure many listeners right now would agree that Black Friday in the South African context is a relatively new phenomenon. It wasn't there, I would say, about maybe for the last 5 years, maybe.
Yes.
It's been around. And the reality of it boils down to the fact that large retailers, or even small ones sometimes, have not met sales targets for the year. This is about sales targets. It's about having to maybe give 13th checks to your employees. And okay, let's not go down that road. But the whole issue of just your targets for the year, it's another promotional scheme to meet those targets. It's not expected to. It's not designed for the benefit of consumers. Primarily at heart, the consumers are the important factor in this whole thing. It's not primarily that. And many individuals tend to overlook the reality of what Black Friday is.
Just on that subject, what do you think would be the major things that people would want to be purchasing during Black Friday? I've seen some of the websites, and they say that people will be keen to buy things like solar geysers, you know, gas stoves, because of the rolling blackouts that may occur should Eskom go more south than it has recently.
I think from the few that I've visited, I see a lot of the tech stuff being pushed, you know, like printers, computers, and those kind of things being pushed. You see, mobile phones, different gadgets, those are being pushed quite a bit, quite heavily on Black Friday. But in the specific example that you're citing there, I think there may be a case for those specific items which are needy items, given the current circumstances of our power outages and the frequency of these kind of occurrences. So those are cases to be made, and that's where consumers need to be responsible. If they feel, you know what, there is a genuine need for this particular product because the price is good, it's different to the regular price, then there's a case to be made for specific items, and that is why I mentioned my five tips for this year, is to have a budget. If you have that budget and it justifies the specific purchase, then by all means you can proceed. From a Sharia standpoint, there isn't any blockage in that respect.
Yeah, because those are items of necessity that could be used for good.
Yes. I recently came across someone who mentioned it. They actually purchase items on promotion and discard it or give it away to someone who is needy. So they benefit from the promotion themselves, but they also give it away to someone who is needy of those specific items.
A very win-win situation. Yes, that's a good idea. I think other things that if I was looking at by purchasing anything during Black Friday, it would be things that would help me either for water improvement, seeing that we are probably going into a drought situation that's worsening across South Africa, and then also, obviously, as I mentioned, for the electricity blackouts, I think that's something that we should take into consideration. With regards to the tech side, I think, and I don't know if Brother Faisal Patel, if he's listening, would agree with me on this, but a lot of the time, tech stuff is pushed out because their shelf life isn't very long. One, two, obviously, you want to get rid of things because with the way tech is evolving, things don't stay fresh for very long, if you can put it that way.
Yes,
so I think that would be one reason why tech stuff is, you know, people try to get rid of it as quickly as possible.
Yes, definitely. It's very much like the cars. You see, in tech, how it works is that the minute the year switches, you're having 2019 now, the minute you switch over into 2020, even if you have something manufactured or launched in November 2019, it's already irrelevant.
It's reached its sell-by date.
So the point is spot on there. That's why tech stuff has to be pushed very fast.
Mm-hmm. All right, and now we come to looking at something that's really important, and this is looking at the refund policy at schools, and you're going to give us some basic insight into that?
Yes, and this is purely for consumer benefit, as was any of our items that are picked up by yourself and I. The issue is, it's a time of year where many individuals are enrolling their kids at school, maybe for the first time, maybe just renewing your child's admission at a particular school, and some schools tend to require a deposit for the new year, you know, to secure your place, kind of thing. Now, a case in Cape Town has arisen where, and this case was taken to the Consumer Goods and Services Ombud, where a particular parent had paid the deposit and secured the place for their child, and it so happened that the parent decided within a short frame of time that they've selected another school, and they were through. It just so happened that the school which was not of their choice, that school decided that they will not be refunding the deposited amount. And the deposit in this case was quite a hefty sum. It was like, I think it was, if I recall from the case information, it was 5,000 rand to secure a place for the child. So the school initially declined to return this deposit, and the case went to the Consumer Goods and Services Ombud, which decided against the school, basically. So I just want to give some basic insight for ordinary parents who may be in this particular predicament. Keep in mind that according to the Consumer Protection Act, while companies or schools may be justified in requiring a deposit amount, if there's a cancellation, they are obliged to provide a reasonable context for the cancellation penalty and not being refundable. They must provide good reason for not being able to refund that particular deposit. It cannot be the case that they simply don't return a cent of the deposited amount. So when I talk about the reasonable grounds for retaining that deposit, we're talking of being able to substantiate or prove how hard it is to replace or difficult it is to replace that customer or that particular child. They must be able to substantiate loss of income or even the steps taken to highlight their constraints in being able to release that deposited amount. So many a time we find that these schools or even companies sometimes have this non-refundable deposit. There's a particular context within the Consumer Protection Act which states that they have to substantiate and give good reason for why that fee is non-refundable. It doesn't make sense in all cases for that reasonable grounds to equate to 100% of the deposit. Many times it's less. The actual fee that they justify to withhold is much less than 100% of the amount you lodged with them. So there has to be some realistic approach in this regard, and many consumers tend to ignore the significance of the Consumer Goods and Services Ombud, which plays a huge role in assisting consumers in reclaiming what it is or having their rights fulfilled. I noticed recently I was doing a small, just browsing around, and I see some schools don't call it a deposit, they call it an enrollment fee, you know, and feel that the enrollment fee is something that will cover them and will allow them to retain 100% of the deposited amount. According to the CPA, even though it may be referred to as an enrollment fee, the same rules apply in the sense that if a 20-day notice is given by a parent, they are entitled to it, number one. Number two is if the school or company fails to substantiate the grounds for retaining the full amount, then they would have to return some portion of the funds to the consumer, to the client. So I hope that this kind of news doesn't apply to anyone, or no one actually has this kind of occurrence, but it pays to know what your rights are so that you avoid this kind of predicament in future.
Inshallah. Mufti, we've come to the end of today's show, and we've got one more topic, but can we use that for next week, inshallah? Jazakallah khair for your time, and I think this has been another interesting slot for us this morning.
Alhamdulillah, Jazakallah khair. I hope if there's any clarity, I'm available on my telephone number at the office, inshallah.
Okay, inshallah. Jazakallah khair. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam.